time and money are very interconnected in our societies. And so I think a challenge for us is to really think about that time could be a dimension of social class and inequality that we don't take seriously enough. So, for example, there's literature on waiting times to get transplants, waiting times in emergency room. And what the literature shows is that people of color generally wait longer for equivalent services. So essentially, what this is saying is that racism is a huge waste of time, especially for minoritized communities.
Welcome to the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing podcast, Aging Fast and Slow. This podcast is supported by the National Institute on Aging Pioneer Award. Thanks for listening. We are Dr. Sarah Zanton
and Dr. Deidre Cruz, your host. For anyone new to our podcast, we speak with scientists, policy experts, and innovators to better understand aging across the life course, with a special emphasis on the sustained impact of racism on health, the impact this has over the life course, and what can be done to tackle these inequities.
Today's guest is Dr. Gilbert G. Dr. G is a professor and chair of the Department of Community Health Sciences in the Fielding School of Public Health at the University of California, Los Angeles. A primary line of his research focuses on conceptualizing and measuring racial discrimination and understanding how discrimination is related to mental and physical health.
Much of Dr. G's research we are discussing today focuses on the social determinants of health inequities of minoritized racial, ethnic, and immigrant populations using a multi-level and life course perspective. Welcome, Dr. G. We're thrilled to be talking with you today.
Oh, it's such a delight to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So, Gil, let's jump right in. What does the term structural racism mean to you, particularly within the realms of historical, cultural, institutional, and interpersonal?
Yeah, so I think it's a big term. And let me give you an analogy, because I think a lot of times people use the terms racism interchangeably across different levels, right? So the easiest level, I think, is the interpersonal, where it's sort of one-on-one hate crimes, microaggressions that individuals perpetrate amongst each other. Then if we go up one level from the personal level to the institutional level, that's where I'm thinking about institutions like healthcare, education, policing, and so forth. These institutions can also discriminate against people as well as groups and so forth. But now the big question is, what's the difference between institutional and structural racism? Well, structural racism, in my mind, is the connections across institutions. And so let me give you an analogy to think about. So there's something called a buckyball, which is essentially a carbon atom that looks like a soccer ball. So imagine the soccer ball. And now if you kick the soccer ball momentarily deflects, but then it just, a second later, it just pops back and looks like a ball again, right? And that's because the force that you exert on that little part of the ball with your foot gets distributed across the entire ball. The structure of the ball makes it stay a ball. And I think that's where it's a useful analogy to think about structural racism, because a lot of times when we think about interventions, civil rights interventions, we're thinking about intervening on housing, intervening on policing, and so forth. But the issue is that, for example, the court system is working alongside the policing system. The medical system is working alongside the police system. And it's these connections across institutions that form structural racism, which is why interventions that focus only on one institution like housing aren't actually very effective, I believe, because we have to intervene on the structure as a whole. And so for me, that's one way to think about the difference between these kinds of racisms.
So we have to rip the soccer ball open.
Yes.
So Gil, we found with most of our guests that there's some pivotal thing in the course of their lives or their professional careers that sort of led them to become interested in thinking about structural racism from a health angle in particular. And I was curious as to what that was for you.
Well, yeah, it actually began at Hopkins. As you know, I'm an alum. And so flashback to the 90s, right? And that was, of course, the Clinton era, and everybody was thinking about primary care and lots of things like that. I was a young 20-something-year-old And I was pretty lost in my doctoral studies because my original intention was to go study neuroscience. And I decided to, you know, pick up an MPH along the way. And I eventually, you know, by chance, made it into the doctoral program at Hopkins, which is a whole story in and of itself. But I was pretty lost. And my advisor, Jeff Johnson, gave me essentially the kickstart to thinking about this, because he said, Gil, why don't you give a lecture to the MPH class on race and health? And I thought, okay, I can do that. Now, the context, right? I'm like, I don't know, 22 years old, you know, ripped jeans, Snoopy t-shirt. And I'm totally stressing out on lecturing to the MPH class, because as you know, on average, the MPH students are very accomplished. You know, you have doctors and nurses and lawyers and so forth. And I'm just this kid who's just kind of out of college. And I spent like a whole month just focusing on this 1 hour lecture. Now, documenting that race disparities exist was easy. That was the easy part of the lecture, right? But the big conundrum was why. And so I went through all the things that you could think of: genetics, healthcare, you know, education, social class, all those kinds of things. And the only thing that stuck out to me was the legacy of racism in our country. That was the one common glue that held together all the different outcomes and all the different groups. And so at that time, there were only a handful of people and a handful of studies on racism and health. And it was a bit of a gamble. I had people say, oh, you should be studying Medicare and Medicaid and not this thing like race, much less racism. And at that time, there was also a debate in the literature where people were saying, oh, race is actually not important. It's just social class, and you're just kind of barking up the wrong tree. So if you're going to actually go that route, you should be studying social class. Luckily, I was maybe too stubborn or too naive to think about that. And then the other thing that was important, in addition to just racism was a logical thing to think about, was also Tom Leviste, who, as you know, was a professor there at the time. And, you know, I went to his lecture on race as a dummy variable, and that was also very influential. So it was a bunch of these things, along with some of the work that was starting to emerge from David Williams and Nancy Krieger, that really just catalyzed my interest.
Wow. Well, and thank you for painting such a colorful story with the Snoopy t-shirt. I mean, yeah. I was the Snoopy t-shirt really yeah. conceptualize yeah. it. Thank yeah. you.
So in some of your papers, you say that a lack of attention to structural racism is why racial inequities endure despite numerous attempts to expand civil rights. And you already talked about the soccer ball. You know, we talk a lot about the life course as well. And so I think bringing in across time matters in that. Can you just talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, when we do interventions on a single sector or institution, a lot of the work just gets pushed around, right? So that's why we keep bringing up terms like, you know, the new Jim Crow or the new racism, right? It's not that racism has ever left us. It's just that the work of racism gets pushed into a different place. And so, you know, for example, we used to have residential segregation that was permitted by law, perpetrated by organizations like the Real Estate Association, as well as local persons. And then once through the 1965 acts, we said, oh, you know, de jure racism on the grounds of residential places is illegal. It just moved into the prison system, right? And so that's why Michelle Alexander's book is so well titled, The New Jim Crow. Essentially, the work of segregation moved from neighborhoods into prisons. And so it's, again, the forces get distributed across the entire soccer ball. Essentially, the forces of white supremacy are a stable structure. I believe that the equilibrium of our society is inequality. We're just built on that foundation. And so until we really start to intervene on all sectors simultaneously, we're probably not going to make durable inroads.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think another great example is with Brown versus the Board of Education. Schools are just as segregated now, if not more, than they were then because mm-hmm. of neighborhood segregation.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So, Gil, beyond chronological aging, you know, one of the more fascinating areas of your work, in my view, and I think mm-hmm. it's in Sarah's yeah. view as yeah. well, is your work on the role of time as a determinant of health inequities. and that it really probably should be considered a social determinant of health that's been shaped by racism as well. So can you unpack that for us and for our listeners that maybe have not had the great benefit of reading that work of yours?
Yeah. So, you know, time for us is a very valuable and limited commodity, right? So, you know, we say waste time is money. You know, time and money are very interconnected in our societies. And so there's this whole body of research showing that things like income, education, and all that are very important in terms of health and health inequities, right? So people with more money tend to live longer, have lower rates of illness, and so forth. And so I think a challenge for us is to really think about time in the same way, that time could be a dimension of social class and inequality that we don't take seriously enough. I think a lot of research shows that there's also racial and ethnic inequalities in time as well. So for example, there's a literature on waiting times to get transplants, waiting times in emergency room. And what the literature shows is that people of color generally wait longer for equivalent services. There's also research that shows that for the same offense in a court proceeding, that people of color serve longer prison sentences and so forth. Even something as mundane, there's a study that looked at pedestrians crossing the street and seeing how long it took for a car to yield to allow that pedestrian to cross the street. And then, you know, this whole research on voter suppression and waiting times to go vote and all these things. So essentially what this is saying is that racism is a huge waste of time, especially for minoritized communities. And so for me, it makes sense for us to really start thinking seriously about time in this dimension. And the other thing that's also important is we need time to recover from illness, right? So when people are sick, it takes time to recover. But when you're working two or three jobs, you don't necessarily have that luxury of time. When people who are lucky enough to have vacations, you know, we say, oh, we burnt out, we need to take time off, those kinds of things. But again, this goes back to time as a resource and it's socially patterned. And it goes back to racial inequalities. And one other dimension of that as well that there bears mentioning on this issue of leisure and racism is it also is very understudied and I think represents an important dimension for future work as well. Because as many of you know, many of the leisure activities we have, like, you know, going on vacation was socially patterned. For people of color, it was not safe to go to many of the vacation spots that white patrons would take. Yeah, so there's that. And then this whole stereotype of Black people can't swim, that goes back to racial segregation of swimming pools. So all these dimensions of time that also feed into leisure as well as monetary resources that are socially patterned, I do believe play into this picture. And I do believe it's a dimension of structural racism. Time structures our day. So time is so important in structuring our lives.
Thank you. And an agency over that time, I think, is part of what you're bringing up. Yeah. So we're going to switch to the COVID pandemic. And as we know, it both exacerbated and laid bare pre-existing structural racism. Has the pandemic illuminated anything for you about structural racism? Or do you feel like you've been doing this since the 90s and you know the score?
I think the pandemic probably did a few things. It didn't materially impact my own work because, as you have said, you know, this is something I've been working on. So what unfolded was almost to be expected in a way. But I think what COVID did for us was, one, it made it more popular to think of racism as a public health problem. It helped illuminate for many people the connections between inequality and health, and especially for people who are not in the field. As you know, within the research field and the public health space, there's been a steady movement over time to really think about racism and all these inequalities. But I don't think that was really in the public imagination until COVID sharpened everything and put it right in our face. I think that was one. I think number two, it did also amplify conversations of discrimination against Asian Americans. Asian Americans, I guess, in the media, kind of wax and wane in terms of how people perceive us, either as a model minority or as you know, something else. And I think especially with all the anti-Asian hate and all the violence, I think it allowed people to think about Asians as people who also encounter substantial amounts of discrimination. And this doesn't really go away. It's just sometimes it gets more quiet in the imagination of the public sphere.
Yeah. So you've done so much work, but we, you know, we're curious about where are you seeing as the next step in your work? And maybe in that, if you could share how you might see the work you've done and work that you're doing actually being translated into policies, practices to have a broad impact.
Yeah. You know, the thing that I've really been thinking about a lot lately, and I'm really struggling on how to think about this, but it's probably the most interesting thing, is really taking this idea of interconnected institutions very seriously. You know, so it's not hard to think about racism at the individual level, especially as Americans, we're in a very individualistic society. And so that level of analysis is pretty comfortable space. But for me to think about how, for example, policing is connected to medicine and how to really study that in a systematic way is a lot harder. And so that's really where I'm wanting to take my work in sort of the next phase of my research, really trying to understand how to think about these complexities and what can we learn from other fields like meteorology, physics, engineering, and so forth, on really how to think about complex systems working together and how do things flow across these systems so that these systems maintain whatever equilibrium they were designed to have, and then how can we disrupt that equilibrium? I don't have any answers to that, but that's really what I've been kind of thinking about. And then going to your question about interventions, you know, I do think it's important to continue the kinds of interventions that people have done, both at the small P policy level and the big P policy level, civil rights legislation, all the way to workplace policies on things like microaggressions and all. I think that's all important. But at the same time, for me, the big struggle, the big lift is really how do we think about this across institutions? And I don't have any answers on that, but hopefully somewhere down the road, if not me, then hopefully some other people who have brighter minds.
Well, and it's so tempting to think about that maybe there are some really powerful people in a room and we could just find them and then it would change all of the structures. But unfortunately, it's not that it's not that easy to pin it on individuals.
Right.
So if we were to take a trip to California, we'd love to.
Sure, let's go.
Please.
And have a look at the GILG vision board. What would we see? What would we see for health equity for you in the next 10 years? What's the vision?
So right now I think we're at a moment where there's a lot of entities that are interested in racism, right? So NIH is interested. You know, they're looking in within their own house, and then they're funding grants on racism, structural racism, and things like that. I guess my worry 10 years from now is that, you know, research is faddish, right? And so if you look sort of over the big arc of, you know, medical work, we kind of wax and wane. You know, things become more popular, like, oh my gosh, it's genetics, epigenetics. Oh my gosh, it's primary care. Oh my gosh. You know, like when I was at Hopkins, we would joke that, oh, we should rename it to the School of Hygiene and HIV Research because everybody was working on HIV. I even have a paper on HIV from my Hopkins days, you know? So I guess part of my worry is that 10 years from now, racism will fall off the radar and be replaced with the next hot thing, whatever that is. But I think because I think racial inequality is built into the fabric of our society, I think we need to be in this for the long haul. It has to be a much larger arc than what we can do in 10 years, in 50 years. So what I would hope is that 10 years from now, we still have the same fervor and interest in thinking about not only racial inequalities, but also inequalities based on gender and class and age and disability that we do have today. So that's what I would hope.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, and we like to close with a question about advice. So could you tell us one of the best pieces of advice you've ever received, or what advice you give to the next generation of researchers, which might be the same answer or they might be two different ones?
Yeah. I think probably the best bit of advice I could offer, one is to take risks. You know, when I think about my dissertation, right? So again, the 1990s, people are saying, oh, don't study race, much less racism, much less, mind you, my dissertation was on Chinese Americans. So to study racism amongst the Mono minority, right, was even more foolhardy in that sense. And luckily, I had people that, you know, were supportive and didn't say, don't do this. Although a number of people did say, don't do this, but at least my committee was supportive. And I'm very, very grateful and thankful to all of them. But at the same time, so many times in my career, I've had people say, oh, don't do this. And I listened very carefully to what they said. And then I made my own decision and I took a risk. It's really important to get advice from people who look out for you and have your best interests at heart. And much of the time, their advice is great. But sometimes you just have to make your own decision and say, I hear what they said. I'm just going to give a shot anyway. And if it doesn't go well, then, you know, so be it. But if it goes well, then maybe something good will come out of it. So that's probably the best advice I would offer to anybody.
Well, thank you, Dr. G, for sharing your work. For our listeners, check out our website, nursing.jhu.edu/aging-fast-and-slow, for the articles and resources referenced in the episode. Have comments, questions, or guest suggestions? Reach out to us at agingfastandslow@jhu.edu.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with a friend, rate it, or write us a review. You may also enjoy the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing podcast, On the Pulse, which explores invaluable stories of how nursing works in today's world. Special thanks to Jennifer McCord for editing and sound design, Rafe Reggie and Florentina Kostaka for technical expertise, Brian Fitzek for production, and Tim Carl and Danielle Kress for web design. See you next time on Aging Fast and Slow.